Hello, how's it going? Welcome along to another episode of Press X to continue. It is Stefan Powell here holding the fort for you whilst Einel is away being a theatre star, treading the boards all over the UK with his stage show. But look, fear not, okay? We have got another special episode with an extra special guest for you this week to keep you busy and enlightened here on Press X to continue. So sit down, or if you're standing up and you can't sit down, don't worry, just get yourself comfortable in the brain, you know, in your mind. Get comfy wherever you are. Wrap your ears around this conversation we've had with one of the brightest minds making games in the UK at the moment. It's a big sell, but frankly, it's true. Now, before I tell you more about who it is, you already know who it is because it says it on the episode description, doesn't it, to be fair? So look, just a reminder, please, it makes such a big difference for us, and so many of you do it already, which we love, but if you haven't subscribed, make sure you're subscribed to us. Comment when you see our posts on social media, whether you agree or disagree or whatever with the stuff that's on there. Like those posts as well. Tell your mates about us, get involved in the Discord channel. It makes a huge difference to us here on Press X. So thank you very much, everybody that's doing that already. Keep up the good work, and please join in if you've not had a chance to do it just yet. Now, you might have played one of these games, right? Thomas Was Alone, which won a BAFTA for the performance of Danny Wallace, the comedian in that game. Maybe you've played John Wick's Hex, seen it on the App Store and you've played that. How about Tron Identity or Tron Catalyst? Maybe you've tried Volume or Solitaire Conspiracy. Maybe you haven't tried any of them, right? But these are some of the most significant independent games made from the UK in the last 10, 15 years, right? Mike Bithell is the brains behind all of them. And he's joined us on Press X to talk about his journey in making independent games. What worked, what didn't, everything in between. It's a really cool chat we've had. Quite a broad-ranging chat as well about his journey into making games, some advice for people who want to go and make games. We also talk about podcasts, actually, as well, because he's one of the team that make a podcast called Play Watch. What is it? Play Watch Listen, which is brilliant. And you should go and check it out, actually, after you've listened to this, of course. So listen, stick with us for a really fascinating chat with Mike. I'm definitely thinking to get loads out of it. So yeah, welcome along to this episode of Press X to continue and our special episode with the one, the only, Mike Bithell. The obvious place to start is for some people, some of our community are tuning on to this will know the name, Mike, but might not necessarily be aware of all of your sort of the ins and outs of your career and the stuff that you've made. And you've been you've had such a varied career and sort of the cool stuff that you've done, which we'll come and touch upon. But how do you introduce yourself at parties, Mike, when people, oh, hey, this is my mate, Mike?
I don't go to parties much, Stefan. You know, I avoid them if I can. How do I introduce myself? I would say, I mean, the one that did the best and people know us for is Thomas Was Alone. That's definitely the kind of a big breakout one many years ago. Number of people who will then, if I say Thomas Was Alone, will say I love that as a kid. And that's, you know, heartbreaking every single time someone says it too good, but it's all right. And then since then, just lots of, we've bounced around genres. We've done kind of one of everything at this point. I think I've got enough games now I could launch a game console, I think. And that's the long-term plan.
The
one of everything.
Yeah,
there you go. There we go. Yeah, because I'm not a humble man when it comes to naming
games. No,
so
do it. Yeah, why not?
I can absolutely do that, yeah. Get on my Kickstarter. Will be the biggest thing since the year. But yeah, it's... since then, lots of narrative stuff. Did some visual novel stuff with the Circular series. Did a John Wick game a while ago. Just did two Tron games with Disney. And now doing kind of other stuff.
Did you always want to be a games maker then? When did that sort of happen for you?
No, I wanted to be an animator. I really wanted to be an animator. And I was, or in kind of, yeah, animation kind of adjacent. And I went to like a uni open day, where I was looking to go to university. And the person who was interviewing me was talking through it with me, talking through the course. And they said, what kind of animation do you want to do? I said, oh, video games. I love video games. I want to do animation for video games. And I'm like, well, we're starting a game design degree. Do you want to do that? And I just kind of fell into the game design direction thing from there. But no, I wanted to be an animator. I was a child actor as well.
Were you?
I was. I wasn't a very good child actor, which is why now I make video games. You know,
what did you, were you in anything that we might have seen, Mike? Or?
Not really. I did a couple of little indie films and like I was on stage in London one time. But yeah, it was fun. But I definitely hit that age where I basically wasn't pretty enough. I was not a good looking enough kid, basically. I hit that age where it's like, I remember I went to an audition to play a young Nicolas Cage in something. And the person auditioning me was like, you are not good looking enough to play. I was like 15. You're not good looking enough to play. And he was like, just like, at that point, I think I'll probably leave the profession then, you know. So I...
So there you are. You're 15. You've been told you're not handsome enough to be Nicolas Cage. Yes. And so you always clearly wanted to do something creative then, Mike, obviously.
Yeah, I always wanted to entertain people, tell stories, do that kind of stuff. So I was looking at that stuff. I think one of the big turning points was I'd done a play in London and I was playing Shenmue on my Dreamcast. And my agent called, because I had an agent. It was very weird being a child actor. It's very strange. I say these things. Yeah. And the show I'd been in London was about to tour the country. And they wanted me to sign on to do the touring version. And I was playing Shenmue and I really liked Shenmue. And it was basically going to be, it was either I go touring, I don't do my GCSEs basically, or I kind of accept that I will fail my GCSEs because I'll have to do them all in a rush.
Yeah.
Or I follow this weird game thing that's, you know, Shenmue, for those who weren't around for it probably or don't remember it, was like one of these big games that kind of showed what games could do storytelling
on the Dreamcast,
world building. It was on Dreamcast,
game.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Incredible game, but very much a game about the promise of where the future of games could go. And I remember it as this fork in the road. I'm sure I'm mythologizing a little bit, but like, and I chose to keep playing Shenmue and I've not looked away since. Yeah.
Wow. So Shenmue's got a lot to answer for you, Mike.
In so many ways.
Yeah. And so you end up sort of starting to work in games development and creating games. Did you always want to sort of have control over the titles you made, or did you enjoy being part of a team, part of a greater whole in terms of that that experience? Or did you always know, no, I want to be number one. I want it to be my ideas and be in charge.
I mean, when I came up, that didn't exist, like, or it hadn't existed for a long time. You know, that you have the kind of, if you look at like the old BritSoft kind of the kind of the code masters, the Oliver Twins, who ended up working for their company Blitz back in the day, like,
yeah.
Though that era of bedroom coders had died out. All those bedroom coders had basically hired people and big companies and they were now big. There wasn't, when I entered the industry, there was no indie scene as there is now. That was, well, there have always been people making games on their own, but it wasn't like the mainstream thing that it is now. It was something, I don't think I was even aware of it.
Yeah.
As other than something that happened in the past. So no, I was basically on that track to like essentially have a career where I bounced between, back then it was Rockstar and Lionhead, and I would try and like have a career in games. And I had lots of people who came up at the same time as me are now kind of doing that and have had amazing careers doing that. But I had a desire a few years into my career, I realized that I could kind of use game tools to make stuff on my own. And I played there was a game called World of Goo, which was like one of the early indie games I played on my lunch break on my work computer. And I remember getting to the credits and seeing it was like two people or whatever from EA. And I just had this moment of like, I think I could do this. Like, and started making stuff in my own time. And I was lucky that I had employers that were completely okay with me doing that. Back then, it was very common for contracts to like say they own everything you make ever in perpetuity.
Wow,
they kind of let me out of those contracts, which was nice. And then, yeah, the first one I kind of got to a finish, I made lots of games and they all kind of failed and flopped and kind of messed around with stuff and didn't finish most of them. But the first one that kind of I finished was Thomas Was Alone, and it came out and no one played it. It came out, it sold like 20 copies to friends. But then for like 4 or 5 months, I was like back to the day job basically. And I was like, maybe this pays for me to get like an iPad or something. Like this would just be a nice treat or a little, you know, a nice meal or something, you know?
Yeah.
And then a couple of YouTubers made a video of it in like late, kind of early December. And then I remember I was traveling home after New Year's Eve and my earnings on Steam had basically crossed a year's salary. I was like, I guess I have to like quit my job now and see if this works. So, and I remember going in to talk to my then boss and asking him for a meeting and him just giving me the most knowing nod ever. Like us going in and him, he basically quit for me in that meeting. Yeah. He was like, I know your game's doing well. I'll see you around. You're fine.
Yeah.
So kind of jumped in. But yeah, it wasn't a plan, not because I didn't have like ambition and wanted to do cool things, but just back then it wasn't a path that many people had walked down. You had Indie Game the Movie, which I'd seen. So I knew there were indies doing their thing. But I remember going, I never left the country for a games event. So I'd never been to like GDC or something. I went to GDC after Thomas Was Alone came out and just met all these people who had done this before and realized, oh, this is a whole lifestyle. If I want to be an indie, I can be an indie. I think when things have gone very well for me, it's been when I've just followed my excitement at making computer games. Like that's always been the right path. And then other stuff kind of comes about as a result of that. That seems to be the path. I enjoy making stuff and I've always leaned into that where I can.
Yeah. And that meeting then with your boss, when you're like, this is it. Were you excited? Were you scared? What was your sort of emotion at that point?
I was excited. I knew at that point, I'd obviously in the time that kind of basically all of December, it was kind of building up steam. So I kind of thought it might happen and I thought it might make enough money that I could kind of quit the day job. But I know it's worth saying as well, like this was a time when Steam just didn't have anything on the front page. So like Thomas Was Alone was on the front page of Steam for like 2 weeks. You're lucky if you're on the front page of Steam for 10% of users for 1 hour nowadays. Like, so it was a very different time. But, you know, I started getting excited and thinking about, like, what would be the games I'd make because, you know, I knew there was money coming in so I could, like, hire people to work with me and I could kind of make some dream projects. And I made most of those in the intervening time, which is really fun. So I was excited, but it was scary. Like, you know, especially, again, back then there wasn't... No, you go and you get a job and you work there and you work really hard and then eventually you get to move on to either Rockstar and Lionhead. And then once you've been at Lionhead for a few years, you go on to Rockstar. Like it was very much, there was a different path I thought I was going to go along.
Yeah.
But it was, it was really exciting. And yeah, being able to then just kind of make my own choices and my own destiny. And I've been, doing that now for... 15 years.
Yeah, it's amazing. So
it's been crazy. Yeah,
in an industry that has been so up and down and chopped and changed and everybody sort of in the middle of one of those periods at the moment to have been doing it for so long is a heck of an achievement, isn't it? So I suppose you didn't imagine at the time that when you released that game in your spare time that it would lead to this, right? That was never the grand plan, I suppose.
No, I think I've said it in interviews before. The success I was assuming was, like I said, either I wanted an iPad because iPads were kind of new back then.
Yeah,
it was very exciting. So I was like, I definitely couldn't afford one any other way. So I was like, I get an iPad. That's like the dream. And then like, if I'm ridiculously lucky, I'll go to Disney World because I'm a big theme park nerd. I was like, that's the pinnacle. It was there as a possibility that could be that I could go and do this as a job, but it was not like, no, the dream was Disney World. The irony is then in the last 5 years, I worked with Disney for 5 years. So I was at the theme parks all the bloody time. So I got there in the end. I got to do
the long way around
at Disney World. So I got to experience Disney World a lot in the last 5 years as a result of that. But like, you're never prepared for it and you hope, but I think honestly a level of kind of skepticism I've always had about like whether I'll be successful has kind of helped me. I think being quite surprised by things going well is a pretty good place to be. You're happier a lot more often. You're more excited because it's not that you're disappointed by when things don't work out. You're just very pleasantly surprised when they do.
And
that seems to have served me well in life.
Being realistic is quite a British thing, isn't it, I suppose?
Or nihilistic, maybe, maybe even further,
So like you were saying, you've gone on then to develop with your company lots of different things in different genres. Like you say on your website, you tend to focus on sci-fi sort of settings and things. So I have to ask, what's your favorite sci-fi setting? What inspired you to want to be a sci-fi dude?
I mean, I was a Star Trek kid.
Oh, like, is it?
Definitely a Star Trek kid. Yeah, Star Trek. I was in the fallow years on Doctor Who.
Yeah,
like I was definitely a kid at the wrong time.
So you were in the 90s. Yeah.
So I was very excited when Doctor Who came back, but I was already like 20 when it came out. And then loved it, but wasn't that one wasn't like a part of my childhood. It was always kind of just a variety show joke, Doctor Who, when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Star Wars I love. Star Trek is the one that, like, that golden era of like TNG, sorry, Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, that was my childhood. That was great.
And just,
that's what I'm always aspiring to. And also the world around those. So like I had all the books of like the fake nonfiction books about Star Trek, like the world building, the encyclopedia stuff, the chronology, like all of that stuff. And like, so that world building has always been something I've been fascinated by.
Yeah. And did it teach you stuff? Or did you learn things by your fandom that you've then applied in your day job?
Oh, Star Trek. Totally. Yeah. Though Star Trek is, I've been emulating and attempting to like, to a greater and lesser extent, Star Trek with everything I've ever done. And I also like, not to go too deep on it, but like the philosophy and the politics and of Star Trek and the kind of that forward-looking worldview, that progressiveness has been a part of, you know, was that raised me basically. That Star Trek stuff kind of was
very really, diverse, very inclusive, wasn't it?
It was always massively ahead of everything. And then that was, as a kid, that was... Yeah, showing the kind of the role models of that show and showing how you could be and how to be smart but not an arsehole. I think that's something that I don't know if I'd say arsehole on your podcast. You can.
It's actually you know, being the cleverest person in the room, which I am never, but you know, so I don't know, it's not speaking from experience, but I can imagine being the cleverest person in the room sometimes, you know, and not coming across like a Burke, it's actually quite hard, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely not the smartest person in any room I've ever been in, but like, I'm definitely a nerd. So like, knowing how to be a nerd in a positive, you know, a non-toxic way, I think that's what Star Trek was very good at, kind of raising me the right way, basically, with that stuff. So yeah, that was very important show to me as a kid.
Yeah.
And I continue to just love Star Trek and anything Star Trek. But yeah.
So I wondered, actually, because obviously we've got this feature on the podcast where we talk about people's unsung hero games, which is a game that maybe doesn't get the plaudits it deserves. It doesn't get the recognition.
You want to just talk for 20 minutes about Star Trek?
I imagine you might have a Star Trek game that could be your unsung hero game, because you can't say one of your own games, Mike, as the unsung hero game, because we're going to talk plenty about your games.
None of them are unsung. They're all massively beloved. So that's...
that's it, yeah.
I never miss.
He's got one of his games got a BAFTA, so come on, Danny Wallace got a BAFTA for it.
He did, bless him. Star Trek, like Star Trek genuinely, the tie-in games was all I played for a while as a kid. Like, if we want to get very nerdy about it, the thing that's interesting about Star Trek games, and I literally could do an hour on this, but I won't. The thing that's interesting about Star Trek games, as opposed to, say, Star Wars games, is Star Wars games, because Star Wars is undeniably the bigger cultural impact. Like, it's everyone knows Star Wars. You have to be a Star Wars fan to have seen every Star Wars. Like, every Star Wars just permeates. So all of their games are like targeting kind of a mainstream audience, very action-oriented, very kind of not very nerdy, not very kind of like, they're just for everyone. They're Star Wars. Star Trek will do the most ridiculously nerdy, pointlessly technologically weird games ever, because their audience, and by extension the people who make the games, are just very nerdy. So like, if you want to talk about Star Trek games, you got to talk about Star Trek Borg, which was an FMV game in the 90s that they used all the sets from the show. So like, as a kid, it just felt like an episode of the TV show. And that was phenomenal. There's been a Star Trek game that's been every genre. I think the one I'd point people to now, in the spirit of unsung games, because I think it is genuinely, it holds up and it's a good game, was Elite Force, which was a first-person shooter. They basically made... It's a Quake mod, because it's using the Quake engine, but there's a lot of stuff in there that you're like, you just drew Star Trek stuff on top of a Quake game here. This is all this is. But that's very good, and nice storytelling, and just it's a nice, weird game that kind of is a fun celebration of Star Trek stuff. If you're someone who's kind of discovered 90s Star Trek on Netflix, and you're like... you're kind of coming to it now and you want something that kind of is a fun expansion of that era, that's the one I would point people towards.
Yeah.
Elite Force.
So talking about, obviously, you know, a lot of people listening to this will come because either they know your work and really enjoy it, or they listen to us, or they want to be games designers and developers, and they look at you as a successful person in the British games industry who's made it work for 15 years. It's been your, you know, career being able to make games. What advice would you give people now? Because like you've already touched upon, the landscape is very different today as it was when you started all those years
ago. Oh, totally, yeah. Yeah, and it is tough out there. We had a very tough year at Bithell Games. Like we had layoffs. We went through some stuff as well. Like it's not a good time in games right now. That's the first thing to say. But I don't want that to dissuade anyone. I don't want young people who are like, or any age of person who's looking to get into games to not do it because there is a bunch of us kind of rightly talking about how bad things are in certain areas. I think there's lots of opportunity. I think it's what I was saying earlier. I think it's the best advice I can muster. First piece of advice is don't listen to any advice on the industry from someone who made it, quote unquote, 15 years ago, because I don't know anything about the modern ecosystem. We release games, but I have incredibly smart people I work with who keep up to date on how to release games in 2026. I am not that guy. I like making things go plinky plonk on a video game. I'm not that guy. So I have no insights on how to, like, you know, successfully sell a game or whatever. But I think the thing that has always, as I said earlier, has always worked for me is just staying true to the desire to make stuff. Like if you are getting into games for any reason other than that you want to make video games, then you will have challenges. I think if you're getting into video games because you enjoy making video games, you'll always be fine because you always get to make video games. There's no one can ever take that away from you. And I think that there's opportunity now more than ever, especially like even the thing that I keep expecting to happen that hasn't quite clicked into place as much yet is hobbyist game development. Is with tools like Godot, I can never pronounce it right. you really can just make a game on your own with no business side of anything. You can do it for the love of the game. And I think that's the thing that's always been my North Star, is I should be making stuff that I want to make, that I want to play, that I want to experience within an audience. And I think that's the advice I'd give people, is stay true to that. Authentically make the thing you want to make. And either it will be a mega success because everyone in the world agrees with you and your game's the best game ever, or worst case scenario, everyone hates it, but you still made something you're proud of and you like. And I think that's either way you're winning in that scenario. So that's my advice to people starting out.
That's great advice. Because we've had a similar question. People have asked us about this podcast because obviously we're now an independent podcast that is done for the love of it by a crew of people that get a kick out of it. And whether or not we become the most watched or listened to podcast in the world is unlikely, but we're having fun making it. We get to chat to interesting people like you, and then you get a kick out of it regardless. And it's hard then when you do something because you're thinking about the pounds and the pence sometimes, or the career progression and all that sort of stuff, because that's when it starts to get a bit muddled and muddied, isn't it?
It's what I'm most jealous of, like people who are starting out now for, compared to me. Because like I was saying earlier, like my career, as I entered the industry at like 21, the way in which you had a career in games was you go and work for those three guys and you go and get jobs there, and that's the job, and you do that. And nowadays, what's so exciting with like social media, with, and I sound like such an old man.
We both do, it's fine.
But it's true, though, like the way in which you can now find an audience, talk to an audience, share what you do with an audience is so far beyond what I could have imagined, and is an incredible opportunity to make stuff and share it. And I think that's the key thing, is enjoy making computer games. It's the best thing ever.
And because it is difficult sometimes for people not to get swept up in, especially if you go and work for a company or whatever, and that are making, because it definitely feels like to me, and I wonder if you agree or perhaps disagree, as someone who makes what we would class as independent games, right, indie games, there seems to be like two tranches of an industry that we live in at the moment, and the stuff that we consume. There's the big AAA, if you will, titles that are chasing the same sort of financial monetization scheme. So a lot of them are free-to-play games that will get you to pay monthly, or you'll cost a massive amount of money up front, and they're so massive and big in scope that you could even conceive of putting that together on your own. And then you've got smaller companies that are able to be a bit more nimble and do more different things, but obviously the scale is smaller. And I suppose often sometimes people think that they have to do the thing at the top, right? But I suppose you don't have to. That's not what a game necessarily is.
No, no, and it's not what a game needs to be, and it's not what you need to make. And I also think what you play can be different from what you make. Like, in terms of my video game diet, I mostly play AAA stuff. Yeah, like, most of what I'm going and playing at home is, well, you should play my games as well, they're quite
good. Well, of course.
But the AAA stuff, like, that's most of what I play. And then I go to work, which is just usually walking across the room to my laptop. And I make stuff that's much more kind of indie and weird and esoteric, and that's okay. Like, it's, and I think I bring a weird perspective because I'm consuming the diet over here, and then I'm producing something over here that's very different. I think that's something I would definitely say to people is, like, yeah, you can make whatever you want. You can be, and I know this is very true, is there's a lot of people who make AAA games who make the most kind of generic bro shooter games you've ever played, but they're going home and they're playing indie stuff, and that's what they have fun with. So as a game maker and as a game player, you can mix and match whatever you want. There's no right way to do it. I think you're right that there is a pragmatic layer to all of this, that, you know, the big AAA companies kind of have to make the kind of game they make to justify the money that they're charging people and justify the microtransactions and all the entire business model machine that is running that, and also appease their shareholders and do that. They are making a specific kind of game that serves their business objectives. In the indie world, you know, I don't have shareholders, so I basically just have to, me and my business partner have to be happy with what we're making, and that's it. So we have a bit more freedom. But yes, because we have that freedom, we don't have as much money, so we have to make stuff that's more concise and limited in that way. So yeah, there's definitely that pragmatism. And I think if you're someone listening to this who's maybe making indie card games in your own time, yeah, you're not competing with Call of Duty, you're not competing with GTA, although don't release on the same day as GTA. That's a piece of solid advice.
That's a solid piece of advice.
Just the absolute. I always feel bad for people who don't like GTA when GTA comes out, because if you don't like GTA, you haven't got any new games for like 3 months comes out, because they're all avoiding it.
And of course, it keeps slipping. Everybody, so it keeps, okay, we'll put it out this time of year. Oh no, wait, no, we can't do that. Let's pull it forward, or let's push it back, or let's whatever.
And every single time that happens, every single boardroom, every single video game company in the world has to have a meeting and go, okay, so GTA's fallen back. It's a whole thing.
Yeah, you know that decision we made a couple of months ago? Can we change it? Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
You also have made games that are played a lot on mobile devices, and I'm interested because we talk about mobile games here, and you know, but sometimes it's again thought of as another thing, when it's just as much a part of the games industry as playing a game on a console or your PC or whatever.
It's a bigger part of the industry.
Well,
than that.
Financially, absolutely. And also, you've got a wider audience base in terms of, you know, demographic, right? The people that can play it because it's on the app stores or whatever.
Yeah.
How tricky is it to navigate that space? Because it's interesting, like, if you just go on your store and you want to just get a game to play while you're on the tube or on the train or whatever, or you're just, you know, you're busy, you are bombarded with options. And as someone who has sometimes choice anxiety, it's like, whoa, where to start? So how do you navigate that as a creator trying to get some space?
I'll let you know if I ever figure it out. Yeah. No, yeah. I was rubbish at mobile game marketing. Like, we've done a couple of things on mobile and they've never been very successful for us for that reason, is that we didn't know how the business model, we don't know how to make a free-to-play game. That's definitely something that I used to, so I did have one job where I worked on, actually worked on a BAFTA-winning Facebook game at one point, which is fun.
Wow.
So I worked in free-to-play for a bit, but I wasn't very good at it, which is why I stopped working in it. So mobile in that space, I've always struggled to work out to kind of do stuff. I think we had some success with a couple of games on mobile, but to be honest, it's never been a big thing for us, because we're just rubbish at it. But I think honestly, for players, if you're interested in really good mobile games, it's a lot of it's just recommendations. I think it's just mates, what mates playing. I on mobile, I've just been playing Threes for the last like 8 years. So wow. that's my only game. That's the only game, as far as I'm aware, it's the only game that's available on iPhone.
That game, it's so good, isn't it? It's so addictive.
I try and play something else every now and again, but I just always go back to threes.
Just drop out. I mean, I was playing a lawnmower sim at one point, which I was advocating for. So, you know, the stuff you get. But it is interesting because it is, like you say, it is such a big part of the game space now, and games creators and people who want to get into it think, oh, well, maybe we can try and do that. But it is, like you say, it's hard to try and break into there. And therefore you feel confident that there's enough people wanting to spend money to pay for games that you've not pivoted to those sort of free-to-play type experiences.
We've not needed to. And also, like I said, I'm not sure I'm very good at it. Like, I think there's a lot of, I remember when I have worked in free to play stuff in the past, I've always kind of, we've always made a game, put monetization in. And then sooner or later, you know, a new employee comes and sits next to me and says, you've been pricing the things wrong. We need to push those numbers in a different direction. Like, I've just never been good at the kind of the conversion and the dark magic of monetization. It's something I've just never. But I think one thing I will say, actually, for people listening to this, again, people who are just kind of starting out, one really great thing about mobile game development is the barrier to entry to get your game onto one of these app stores is very low. Mm-hmm. It's one of the reasons there's so much stuff on there and you get bombarded by when you go on. But like, if you're someone who's just starting out, you just want to, you want to make something and you want to get it out to an audience, which is what you should be trying to do. It's the point. Then releasing on Android or iPhone is relatively painless compared to, you know, coming out on Steam is pretty straightforward. That's not too bad. Console is a very involved process. So like that's the levels of difficulty. And then within the consoles, and NDAs prevent me from saying, there are some consoles that are very hard to release on and some consoles that are very easy. And it's not what people think. So I think if you're someone starting out, that can be a very straightforward place to put your game out is on mobile. So I think it's worth maybe trying, if you're making something and you're like, I just want to get a game out there, I want to release it for free, and it's this little idea I've had, I think mobile is a great place to put it. That makes sense.
Yeah. Now, I really wanted to talk to you because I knew, obviously, you were coming on today about this thing that we've touched upon a couple of times in on the podcast, but not in a sort of any depth. And we spoke about a couple of weeks ago. We had Shay Thompson on. We were talking about what we're excited for 2026. And I was talking about Fable because I remember the Fable games because of their Britishness, if you will.
Oh, yeah.
You know, when Stephen Fry was in a Fable game, do you know what I mean? There were British gags, and I suppose that was on an era where Britain really punched above its weight and still does in the game space. But in terms of not just in terms of the creative vision behind the game and those who created it, but also what you saw on screen. But I wonder if we're not actually culturally British, I wonder if we haven't been seeing as much of that recently. And in fact, the game that sort of, Thank Goodness You're Here. Did you play? I don't know if you had a chance to play Thank Goodness You're Here.
I didn't, but I've seen stuff on it. I mean, that was the first game I was thinking of. Yeah,
100%. Only works in Britain, right? Because of its satire of a very particular part of the UK. But you've had, we talked about Danny Wallace earlier. I think Sue Perkins you've worked with in the past, right? So you've had sort of British elements in some of your titles in the past. Do you think we will ever see some that sort of come around again, or we are living in sort of an amalgamous culture now where when it comes to movies and television and games, it's all sort of Hollywood or actually increasingly South Korean influence or whatever. I'm interested to see if you think that there's still a space for Britishness, quote unquote, in games in the future.
I think so. Yeah, I think there's always going to be games that do that. I think there's and there's lots of cool cultural stuff to play with there. I think what we are seeing is that more and more cultures are being let into the party with this stuff, which obviously is gonna take away some of the stage time from the UK. But like I think it'll always be there. I think I'm interested. I think the new Fable seems to be kind of going back to that well as well, like from the stuff we've seen with that. My biggest memory of Fable was playing it, wanting to play it as an evil vegetarian, because I'm a vegetarian and I'm evil. And I was like, I wanna play a vegetarian. What I didn't realize was that tofu, if you eat tofu in Fable, it like pulls you back towards the good side. So I was basically doing the most heinous, evil stuff in that game and then eating some tofu to replenish my health and absolutely undoing my hard work. It is possible, though. I managed to max out an evil tofu eating guy. Anyway, yes, I think it's there. I think it's possible. I think some of my games, I say, have pushed more into that than others.
Yeah.
I also want to start the petition, get Sue Perkins in more games, because she's phenomenal.
Yeah.
And she's a massive nerd as well. I remember when we were recording it was Earthshape, it was a VR game I did with Sue. And we were recording that, and she was very excited because No Man's Sky Planets had started to be named with the Bake Off references.
Oh wow.
And she was hosting British Bake Off at that point, and she was so excited there were like Bake Off named planets in No Man's Sky, and she's geeking out over that. No, she's really cool. So I want to see her in more games. So that's it. More Sue Perkins, I think, more than the British thing. I just want more Sue Perkins games.
Yeah, also I'm subtly having a campaign for more Welsh accents in video games, because not that many, Mike, so just say.
Well, even I don't have one, and I'm half Welsh, so
I mean,
I've ditched it. I've absolutely anglicized my voice over the years.
Well,
to,
you know, I'm
generic Southern English.
Your best half will want to have a, you know, a Welsh voice in your next game. Just saying that, you know, if you happen to know any Welsh broadcasters with a relatively thick accent,
know if I've ever had a Welsh accent in one of my games. Actually quite damning. That's quite. It's just a lack of representation. I feel bad about it. I'm growing and learning though through this conversation.
Come on.
I know, I'm a Star Trek progressive. I should be putting Welsh people in my games. I will do better. I will do better.
But talking about this, British in games, and interesting, you touched upon it earlier with your sort of discovery of Doctor Who later on in sort of your sci-fi journey. The sort of lack of, and I've had this conversation with Russell T. Davis a lot. So people who aren't sort of across Doctor Who, Russell T. Davis is
me too. Weirdly, no, I'm joking.
Is the showrunner of Doctor Who, so he's sort of in charge. Yeah. And I make a TV show about how they make the TV show, and I've asked him a few times, like, Doctor Who and games, isn't there a thing there? And it's never quite happened. There's never been like a Doctor Who game. And I wonder, you know, you're a sci-fi guy. You've talked about it. I wonder if you ever thought about trying to bridge that gap? I wonder why it hasn't happened.
I could do it. I could make a mean Doctor Who game. We weirdly have had lots of chats with lots of people because we've done some licensed stuff. We did, as I said, we did John Wick and Tron. So, but yeah, no, Doctor Who, I think there's the interesting game design kind of challenge with Doctor Who, I imagine, as someone who's not, you know, worked on one, so doesn't know, is the Doctor needs... The Doctor is like the most ridiculously capable character in all of fiction, right? Like the Doctor gets there in the end, or every time. And it's kind of, so playing as the Doctor is very challenging, because what are the verbs and mechanics of, you can't just have a press the big red button at the end of the episode while saying something cool button in a game. You need to kind of how do you make the Doctor... if you are going to make a game where you can play as the Doctor, how do you make that compelling? And if you're not going to make a game where you play as the Doctor, then that's a tougher sell potentially. So there are a couple of cool VR games, right? I think those, I've not played those, but I know people who said those were fun.
Yeah, there are experiences out there, but I've often wondered, I think, you know, it's definitely got the fan base for it. I think also a challenge is the Doctor doesn't shoot anyone. You know, and often a mechanic in a, you know, in a game, an action game where you're playing
like a gun.
Hero,
it's an easy mechanic.
Do you know what I mean? You shoot, you know, like a, you know, Star Wars games, you shoot someone. The Star Trek game you referenced earlier is a first-person shooter. You know,
it's a first-person shooter. Yeah,
so it is an interesting challenge, isn't it? For someone, someone's got to crack it, surely. Because I think they'd be, I mean, no doubt they'd be open to a conversation about it if it was the right idea. But
absolutely.
So if it's not you, well, it should be you, Mike. Someone will come up
one
with
day. We'll have a conversation. Yeah.
So what do you play? You're talking about your sort of love of AAA games, Mike, is the games that you play. What are those? What do you unwind with?
I mean, I'm definitely a first-person shooter guy, so I think Titanfall 2 is the greatest video game ever made.
It's a good show.
That's good.
It's so fluid. The gameplay is
just
so fluid.
Perfect. That single-player campaign in Titanfall 2, I still replay maybe once a year. I just love it so much. Big Halo fan as a teenager.
Yeah.
I think, like... I'll play most stuff as it comes out. The things, I mean, Cyberpunk was the big one. With Cyberpunk, I didn't play when it came out because of all the bad press. So I only played Cyberpunk like 6 months ago. So I had the best experience with Cyberpunk. I played like the peak of Cyberpunk. So I'm playing, I'm like, this is a great game. I don't know why anyone had any complaints about it. This is fantastic.
What's wrong with this?
Video game.
Yeah.
So that was really good. That was, and I was a big fan of like immersive sims, and like it felt like a Deus Ex game almost, like on a crazy budget. I just loved that. And then weirdly, recently I have been playing quite a bit of indie stuff. So I quite like The Drifter. Have you played that yet?
I haven't played The Drifter.
That was great. That's really, it's a really good, so like an old school point and click game, and it's just phenomenal voice acting, beautiful visuals, great music, like really doesn't go where you expect it to go. Just a really interesting, The Drifter, that's really good. And I was playing earlier, game that just came out. What's that called? Relooted.
Okay.
That was really good, which is a parkour stealth game where you play as a heist crew of Africans re-stealing African objects that have been stolen and put in museums across the world. So you're basically doing heists on museums. And it's brilliant. It's really fun. So it's really good.
Amazing. I'm going to stick that on the list.
Really fun.
Yeah.
Great visuals, really fun, futuristic kind of silliness, and then the like side-scrolly parkour stuff. So that's really good too. Yeah. So yeah, I've been playing a few things, but
does that mean you're quite like you're feeling quite positive about the sort of future? Because I think you've already touched upon it. It was a tough 2025 for you, having to make some layoffs in the company and things not quite going to plan. How do you feel, you know, about this year and the years ahead?
I feel good. I mean, in terms of the industry at large, I think there are big challenges. I think there's a lot less money in games than there was even a few years ago. Partially that's the big boost around COVID in investment. Partially it's all of the tech sector moving on to this AI stuff, which I have strong opinions on that maybe we don't need to go into. So it means that there's just not much investment in games right now. So if you're the people who are really struggling right now in games, everyone's struggling, but the people who are really struggling are the people who are at that kind of mid-size, who are, you know, need investment, need platforms, funding stuff, need money basically flowing in. I think what we're hitting with games now, unfortunately, will be, you know, it would be a greater divide. The divide you were saying earlier, kind of the smaller indies and the bigger AAAs, I think that gap is going to widen even further.
Mm.
But on a personal level, I'm having a really good time. I'm making something interesting right now, and I'm excited to kind of share that with people. But that is a much smaller game than we've made in a little while, so it's interesting. But I do think, it's going to be a tough few years for the games industry. We'll see. Normally, you're hoping for a new console launch or a GTA to fix it, and I'm hoping. I don't know. We've got a new GTA. We'll see how that goes.
Yeah.
It's a tough time to feel massively optimistic.
Yeah.
But there's always an opportunity, and there's always video games, and there's always cool video games, and there's, you know, that will keep going, and that's going to be fun.
And is that because it draws a big GTA 6 will pull new players in, right? And then all of a sudden, I enjoy playing that. I want to try something else, but I don't want to spend another $100 on a game or whatever that's going to cost. And so I might spend 10 on this little title over here. Oh, that's really fun. And I'll try another one.
Yeah. It pulls audience. Essentially, I mean, this has always been true, but it's very true in the present day, is everything's about attention. It's all about getting people's eyeballs on stuff. The reality is the games industry as a whole is not really funded by people like us or people who listen to podcasts about video games. The industry as a whole is funded by a person who buys a PlayStation and plays GTA. There are a lot across the world. There are a lot of consoles under televisions that have not been switched on in 6 months.
Yeah.
And it's those people switching their consoles back on. And as you say, getting back into that habit, getting used to going, oh, I could play something else. Buying GTA, which puts money into the ecosystem of the consoles, and you know, those console guys go, oh, well, we've got some cash flying around. We should invest this in some indie games and see if we can make it. You know, it just starts to revitalize and push things a bit. Those big events that gain attention, those have massive kind of repercussions and kind of echoes through the whole industry.
Yeah.
And we haven't had one in a little while. Like the Switch 2 was the most recent, but that was kind of, in a weird way, felt a little niche in terms of how much attention it got from like the bigger world. So.
Yeah, I think it's because maybe, I know there was a new Mario Kart with it, but that was it, isn't it? I think software ultimately sells.
It's always going to push it, yeah.
Gets more attention, right, than hardware does. And that's why I was a big fan of, I thought E3 was an important event that we used to have every year in LA as a big gaming show, because it got...
Yeah.
I used to be sent there for the BBC, for example, you know, and that's that, and you, you'd see gaming in places you don't normally
exactly.
see it.
Exactly. Yeah.
I still think it. Do you ever get frustrated with the fact that games are seen? Because I know you're one of your podcasts, obviously, about television and film and other parts of culture that we're still. I'm asking people this a lot, and people always move on from the conversation, but I'm just fascinated by this idea why games still isn't thought of necessarily in the same way by the man on the Clapham omnibus or whatever the saying is for your median person in the UK. I do find it fascinating that it hasn't cut through in that sense. I thought it would have done by now.
Yeah, it's. I remember. I mean, I'm a bit of a nerd for like film history, and like this debate happened in film for like 50 or 60 years, and we just don't remember because we were born after it.
Yeah.
But essentially, the thing that made film become considered an art form was all the people who didn't consider an art form died. That's a horrible. Horribly blunt way to phrase it. But if you look at the population, like most people now.
And Star Trek taught you all of this.
Star Trek taught me all of this. This is more Klingon.
Okay, fine.
But like we are generationally, we are moving to a point where most people on the planet will have played video games at some point in their life.
Yeah.
Very soon. And I think that will have an impact. But I also think games are just very early in their evolution. If you look at I mentioned earlier, I'm a theme park fan. Like theme parks, I would make an argument that theme parks are as much an art form as games are in terms of how they tell stories, how they build worlds, how they immerse you. I'd argue that Disneyland arguably is the first video game in the modern context. Like it's how we think about it. But if you think about like how long it took for theme parks to be taken seriously as something that wasn't just for kids, where you have things like Disney adults as a concept now. That park's been open for 70 odd years. Like it took a while. Like it builds, these things have to build and they have to grow momentum. I also think games are something that a large number of people do put aside as they get older and then come back to later. So I think that's another thing that we're always kind of battling with is that there is this kind of multi-generational aspect to it where you do take a break. I remember hearing someone at Lego talk about this as a concept as well, because it's a phenomenon they have, that basically the audience for Lego is people, under 16 and people over 30. Like there's a gap in the middle where you don't buy Lego, but then there's an audience that definitely comes back. And actually now I think the adult audience of Lego is like, it's not 50% of the audience, but it's like much higher than you would assume. I think games are similar in that sense, that we are a childish thing on some levels. And that's obviously a massive, it diminishes a lot of the achievements we've had in the medium. But I think that's how the audience kind of perceives it. So I think that will just continue to age up and evolve as more and more generations kind of grew up with video games. Yeah. The thing that I think I've said this as well in interviews before, but like the thing that was very exciting to me was, my first job in games, I worked on licensed games for someone else. So I worked on like SpongeBob games and that kind of iCarly as well. Weirdly, the iCarly game I worked on is like a meme in Brazil. So like Brazilians get very excited when they realize I worked on that game. I have no context for that at all. But we worked on those games, and those games were very cheaply made. They were very much kind of something that a gran would accidentally buy for their kid when the kid actually wanted like a quote unquote proper game. And there wasn't much respect when you were in the rooms with their license holders. It was just a lunchbox. It was just a tie-in thing. I remember going into meetings on John Wick and the executives, the suits around the table, I was sat in like a really lovely boardroom in Lionsgate talking about what we could do with the game. And realizing that the suits were all people who had grown up with games, one guy literally was like, we want to make one of the good licensed games, like GoldenEye, not one of the crap ones. Yeah. I was like, we just aged up into positions of power as a gaming industry. The games, the people who are around the industry now grew up with this stuff, and they're not just, it's not a lunchbox. John Wick, we were having conversations. And this is true of Tron as well, but they were never conversations about us making like a cheap tie-in thing. It was always, how do we expand this universe? How do we tell a different story? The filmmakers get excited and involved. That stuff is, it's a microcosm, but that feels like a shift. And that will just continue through. But yeah, basically, the way we'll know it worked is, we'll be in our old age and we'll find ourselves wheeled out as like the old men of the industry, and we'll know it finally happened. It's funny when you see like footage of like, you know, Charlie Chaplin as an old man, and he's like being taken so seriously and elevated. But you think like of when he was like in his 20s and 30s, everyone just mocked him as this idiot making stupid throwaway films for the idiots, you know. Yeah. And that's it does shift. It just takes a lot of people dying. It's a horrible thing to say, but it's true.
Well, Mike, listen, it's been a joy talking to you. Thank you so much for your time.
This was an optimistic way to end
let's turn it to a positive just to finish off, I suppose. when you look back at your 15 years and all the different stuff you've been able to achieve with your company and the games that you've made and things, what makes you proudest, or what makes you smile the most?
It sounds cheesy, but it's true. It's the people. It's the number of like amazingly talented people I've been able to work with, to collaborate with. I've been around long enough now that I have seen like careers happen. I've been able to like work with someone early on and see them develop and you know, have those kind of those experiences of kind of seeing someone really grow into themselves or circle back. You know, I was at an event last year, and just like someone who I'd not seen in like 12 years, we'd worked together on one thing and hadn't stayed in touch, just kind of coming up to me and like telling me about their new thing they're working on. Like, just that's the stuff that's exciting to me, is the community aspect of it, the people. That's always going to be the point for me. The making of things is a great way of meeting people and collaborating with people, and that's always going to be that's the joy for me, learning from them and growing with them. It's great.
And what should people get excited about that you're working on, or you've got available soon or now? Or
People should definitely listen to Playwatch Listen. It's a much worse produced podcast than this one. It's a messy, messy podcast that we make. Yours is much more professionally made. I respect it. And then also just, yeah, I think we have got something that we'll be talking about soonish, but I can't talk about it right now. But that's really exciting. And I think that's something I'm really proud of. So I guess follow me on social media and I promise when we come out with it, we will make sure you hear about it.
Oh, yeah. Exciting. We're looking forward to that. And yeah, Playwatch Listen. We've had Austin on. We've had you now on, Mike. Now we've got to get
Alana.
We'll
be Alana on your behalf.
We've done play, we've done watch. Now we need to do listen. So we've done all three of the elements. Mike, it's been a joy chatting with you. Thank you so much for giving us your time. It's been really fascinating and interesting getting your take on how you've got to where you are and your take on the current situation of stuff. And maybe the germ of an idea for the first big Doctor Who game we've had in ages. Maybe that happened today.
This was the inspiration. Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
Mike, cheers, mate. All the best.
Cheers.
Right, congratulations for being with us till the very end, for beating the end boss, you XC beasts. We're going to be back in your feeds once again next Tuesday. Until then, look after yourselves and keep busy on the Discord. See you soon.